Well, that was a nice surprise. Thank you very much. I will hang this with great pride and pleasure right outside my office back in New York. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for being here tonight and for all that you do, have done, and are ready to do in the future. For what is, without a doubt, the greatest human rights struggle, not only of our day, but of all time. Because if we cannot secure the right to life, every other right is lost. If we can secure the right to life, then we have a hope and a foundation for building a world of justice and peace. But only if we can secure that foundation. And these are great days to be part of the pro-life movement. These are days of accomplishment and of success. These are days when the message that many of us have preached for years, even through some very dark years, that we are in fact on the winning side and that we are making tremendous progress and that we will see victory in our lifetime. When those of us preaching that message were greeted with some skeptical stares and doubtful comments in reply, nevertheless are now being told, you know, I remember you saying that some years ago, and now it looks more and more like that's true. We have seen in the last few years, for example, over the last few election cycles, more and more voters not only voting, but voting in such a way that shows that they understand that the first obligation of government is to protect the lives of its citizens, and that any guarantee to its citizens that they're going to grant them all kinds of other rights, privileges, and benefits, that those promises are false, that those promises in fact are illusions, if those candidates and office holders aren't ready to defend the most fundamental right, the right to life itself. We have seen more and more voters exercise that conviction in the voting booth. And therefore, we have been able both on a state and federal level to make unprecedented progress. There has been more state legislation. And as you well know, here in Michigan, sometimes some of this legislation that benefits the unborn can even be signed into law by pro-abortion governors. There has been more success with state legislation advancing the cause of life in the last several years than there has been since the time of Roe v. Wade until today. There has been more progress on the federal level. And not all of it clearly understood by grassroots pro-life people. But let me give you one very, very critical example that I don't think is spoken about often enough. The first major piece of pro-life legislation that President Bush signed was the Born Alive Infants Protection Act. Now, this piece of legislation says that if a child at any time of pregnancy, at any stage, is born alive, that that boy or girl is to be treated as a person. Even if the birth of that child is the result of a failed abortion. Now understand what's happening here. Within the world of the abortion industry, what is called the dreaded complication by abortion practitioners is the complication of a live birth. When you think about it, what can go wrong with an abortion procedure? Well, a lot of things can go wrong, and a lot more things do go wrong every day with abortion procedures than people ever hear about, resulting in serious injury or death to the mothers who thought that they were walking in to exercise a simple legal choice. But the most dreaded of all the complications is that the abortion will actually fail, and the child that the abortionist was trying to kill ends up living. What do they do then? Do they suddenly have to shift gears and start trying to save the very same being that they were just trying to kill? What do they do? What if the child is outside the womb? Are they even legally permitted to kill that child? Well, thanks to this law, the answer is not anymore. But prior to this law, that wasn't so clear, especially given the fact that it was routine practice to kill the children anyway. The Born Alive Infants Protection Act introduces, therefore, a necessary prerequisite to the day when every child at every stage of development will, in fact, be protected by law. And that requisite distinction is simply this: the law can protect the child even if the mother doesn't want the child to live. Understand what's being said here. Abortion itself is still legal, but if the child, in the process of being aborted, survives, the decision of that mother to have that child killed no longer holds sway over the destiny of that child. You see the critical importance of establishing in law that presumption? That in fact we can protect these children? That in fact there is a place where they can go beyond the destructive force of a decision to abort, even when that decision was already exercised over the life of that very child? This is tremendously significant, brothers and sisters. And that was just the first step. And of course, we know there have been several critically important pieces of federal legislation that have passed since then. We don't have the leisure tonight to review them all. But this is just part of saying that these are times of tremendous progress for our movement, not only politically, not only legislatively, but even in that seemingly immovable glacier that we call the Supreme Court. Brothers and sisters, the glacier is moving, and it's moving in our direction. I'm in Washington, D.C. quite a bit. We have an office, as some of you know. Our office is directly across the street from the Supreme Court. We're right behind the court on 2nd Street Northeast. We can look out the window of our office and literally look into the window of some of the private studies of the justices. And I'm trying to figure out how to send them a little message, you know, or in some cases, you know, what some of us used to do in school, you know, the spitball, you know, through the round. I decided against that. But anyway, the point is that even within the court now, there is a strong consensus, and I'm telling you this on the basis of very, very well-informed insiders in the Supreme Court with whom we have regular contact. Within the court right now, it is not, the consensus is not a question of if or whether, but simply a question of when Roe versus Wade will be reversed. Even people who believe that abortion should remain legal are more and more convinced of the fact that this decision was not the way to make it legal and isn't the way to keep it legal. The decision is faulty on so many levels and in so many ways. This decision will, in fact, be thrown on the ash heap of history before long. Now, brothers and sisters, much speculation abounds as to how the court will do that, and we simply don't know. People who are students of these things and spend all their time trying to figure out the next moves of the court also know that the Supreme Court is one of the most unpredictable, secretive bodies not only in the United States but in the world. And speculation abounds as to how this will happen. And of course, so many of you here in this room understand that the prevailing opinion is that when Roe versus Wade is in fact reversed, the matter of the legality of abortion will be returned to the states. Because you understand, Roe versus Wade did not only take away protection from the unborn, but took away from the states the right to protect their unborn. This is a double insult. States have the right to govern themselves in many, many respects, and protecting their own children should certainly be one of them. But Roe versus Wade took that away, and therefore a reversal of Roe would mean returning that right back to the states. However, it could also happen another way. Not only could the court say that the Constitution does not require abortion to be legal, does not require that the states be unable to protect their own unborn children, it could reverse it a different way and say, well, the Constitution does in fact require that we protect the unborn, because the unborn are persons under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. Just like Roe versus Wade said, they're not persons. Reversing that would mean to say they are. That's one way the court could act in this particular matter. And the court, as far as when it will reconsider Roe versus Wade, understand something, brothers and sisters. The court has already accepted the partial birth abortion case. For the second time, this procedure will be the subject of the court's scrutiny, and specifically the ban on this procedure that was signed into law by President Bush. Later this year, this case will be heard. The court could conceivably use the partial birth abortion case as the opportunity to review Roe versus Wade. You're going right to the heart of the matter, after all. Remember, the last time the court directly ruled on Roe was in 1992 with the Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision. It came within one vote of reversing Roe. Understand that that decision was about a state law, all right, not banning abortion, but simply regulating it. Now we're talking about a federal law that actually does ban a particular type of abortion. Would that not be, for all the more reason, an opportunity for the court to review and possibly reverse Roe versus Wade, or certainly come up with some, again, very important prerequisites to the day when that will in fact happen? These are great and tremendous days to be part of this movement, because we also see momentum in our direction on so many other levels, too many even that we have time to talk about, but one in particular that we should not miss is what's happening among younger people. Younger, let's define that for our purposes as born after 1973. If you, and everybody who goes to the March for Life in Washington says this, this is like a big youth rally. More and more young people marching and praying and singing and passionately committed to seeing abortion end. And not only in things like the March for Life, but in organizations on college campuses throughout the nation, high school pro-life activities, opinion polls among high school students showing more and more of them rejecting the ethic of abortion. Do you know what most of these young people will say if you ask them, why are you involved in the pro-life movement? Why are you against abortion? Their answer is very simple. It could have been me, they will say. I know that I'm a survivor, they will tell you. When Chief Justice Rehnquist died, a group of young people prayed at the steps of the Supreme Court, "Oh God, send us a replacement, send us a successor to the Chief Justice who will respect our lives," they prayed. Our lives. Our lives. You see, they're defending themselves because they realize that when they were in their mother's wombs, they were declared and they were considered to be non-persons. And even if their parents would have never thought of aborting them, they know that legally speaking, it could have been them. Nick Cannon, young rap singer, you may have seen his music video called "Can I Live?" And Nick made that music video to thank his mother for not aborting him. She actually considered doing so. And the video shows her walking into the abortion facility and then changing her mind and coming back out. And at the end, he's embracing her. Thanks, Mom, for giving me life. And so when this music video came out earlier in the year, Nick was asked, are you becoming some kind of pro-life activist? And you know what his answer was? He said, it's not so much that I'm pro-life. I'm just pro-Nick. It could have been me. You can't stop that momentum. If an entire generation is saying it could have been me, and in speaking up for the unborn, they know they're speaking up for themselves. There's a motivation there, brothers and sisters. There's a momentum. There's an energy. There's a foundation that cannot and will not be stopped until the unborn are protected. And we will see it in our lifetime. And those of us who do strive and who do work and who do the public prayers and the protests and going in front of the abortion mills and intervening for those who have not been reached by all the educational activity and the preaching and the literature, have not been persuaded, and they're finding themselves walking through those doors anyway. And there are people right there on the front lines pleading and begging and offering that last minute help, that final appeal. For those of us who are engaged in that activity, again, there has been a victory. With the Supreme Court finally awarding to Joe Shidler and all those, quote, co-conspirators with him across our land, the vindication of their First Amendment rights, and the vindication by the court to say laws that were passed to stop organized crime don't apply to peaceful pro-life activity. And that was a great victory. It was said earlier this evening that Senator Stabenow should be afraid. That is true. And every candidate and office holder who believes that abortion should remain legal should likewise be afraid. Do you know why? Because there is a tidal wave going across this country. And despite the political calculations and understandable worries that many have about what's going to happen in the 2006 elections for candidates who support our cause, I'm going to stand before you tonight and tell you, brothers and sisters, that the momentum we saw in 2004 with the so-called values voters that seemed to take the media by surprise, I hope it didn't take you by surprise, it certainly didn't take me by surprise, because I was going across the country from coast to coast, speaking in cities, large cities and small country towns, and I saw it with my own eyes. And on election day afternoon, I was in my capacity as a private citizen, believe it or not, what I did for the first time, election day afternoon 2004. I went to the polling places in Florida, and I preached outside the polling place to the voters who were lined up. In my capacity as a private citizen, I paid for the trip myself and all the rest. You know, I was following the law down to the last little detail. But I was dressed like this. One guy, Kerry supporter, looked at me and he said, "Oh, you should be ashamed of yourself out here doing that." I said, "Get used to it." And that afternoon, as you know, there were a lot of nervous jitters. Oh, my goodness, you know, all the initial results looked like they were going in Kerry's favor. And some of the people across the country with whom I had been working and strategizing started calling me on my cell phone. Oh, my goodness, you know. And one of them called me up and said, "Hey, Jim, happy election day." I said, "Oh, I'm not so sure about that." I said, "Jim, don't pay any attention. They never understood us. They don't understand us now, and they never will. Turn off the TV, get back outside, keep handing out the literature, keep getting the people to the polls, make sure the drivers are getting the people there, and pay no attention. I tell you tonight that the momentum that we saw generated in the 2004 elections will not only continue this year, it will increase and it will astonish the media again. It will astonish all those who think that they are experts in politics. Let me tell you something. I never considered myself a political expert. I don't now either. But I know this much. To be a political expert, you have to be a people expert. Because ultimately, brothers and sisters, it's about people. It's about people, furthermore, who are motivated. And it's about people who are counted and are willing to be counted. Now, I was recently speaking out at Thomas Aquinas College in California, one of the great Catholic colleges in our country. And I was delighted as I was walking over in the early evening to the hall where I was going to give my talk. I saw an orange grove. And why was I so delighted? I wanted to go over, and I did go over, and I stood underneath one of the orange trees, and I reached up my hand, and I put it on the closest orange that I could reach, and I had my assistant snap a few photos. The reason being that when I give talks about elections and politics, I always talk about going for the low-hanging fruit. Now, you know this principle. And I want to put it in your mind from now, where we're still a ways out from the election, but it's not too early to get all the engines up in full gear, brothers and sisters. The low-hanging fruit. Here's what I mean. Ultimately, the one who wins an election is the one who gets the most votes, right? I mean, we all know that. That's obvious. But you got to think that through a little bit. Because getting the most votes, all right, doesn't count why they voted that way. The vote of a fully informed, fully committed person who has been committed to that the ideology that caused them to vote a particular way for decades counts no more or no less than the person who never voted before, wasn't even sure that he or she was going to vote, and voted for the person that they thought had a nicer tie. Do you realize that both votes have exactly the same weight? Isn't that interesting? And so there's no question here about any kind of analysis of who the voter is or why they voted. In the final analysis, it's a pure numbers game. Now, you've got to think this way when you're trying to influence people for an upcoming election because, you know, we who know the principles, we who know the issue, we know the most important issue being the right to life, we are rightly interested in converting everybody. And we should be. And we've got to work on that all the time. Bringing people to an understanding of the truth. Because we believe in truth. We believe in principles. We want people to grasp them. And we all have, you know, our Uncle Joe's and Aunt Mary's who don't agree with us. Cousin Jim and, you know, Cousin Sally that don't agree with us. Now look, there's a lot of things you can do for them to help them understand and to help them come around, starting with prayer. You give them good pro-life literature. You have some discussions when the time is appropriate. Don't let them degenerate into shouting matches. But do all kinds of things during the course of the year to convert Uncle Joe, Aunt Mary, and whoever knows who else. But when it comes to elections, you know, some of us will go to Uncle Joe and say, you know, he's been voting for pro-abortion candidates for decades, and This time, the prize is going to be I'm going to get his vote for the candidate who's pro-life. And you end up spending hours upon hours upon hours of precious time and energy trying to convert and convince Uncle Joe. You might succeed, but if you succeed, it's one vote. My recommendation, go for the low-hanging fruit. See, Uncle Joe is that orange way, way at the top of the tree. You got to do some climbing to get there. It's going to take 10 times as long to get that orange as it takes to get the one that's right within arm's reach. In the hours you spend trying to convince Uncle Joe, which again, you might succeed or you might not, you can activate 100 people who don't need any convincing, but who might just be forgetful. Maybe they moved and they didn't register to vote again in their new district. Maybe election day is just going to pass them by because they're just not tuned into the political process. Or maybe on election day, they literally don't have a ride to the polls. Or maybe they forgot they were going to be out of town on election day. They didn't bother to get their absentee ballot. And you can make sure that their vote counts. And you're not going to have to convince them of anything. You're just going to have to give them a phone call, knock on the door, invite them to come with you to the polling place. You see what I'm saying? Invest your energy in activating the people who are already convinced before you invest your energy in people whose vote it's going to take a whole lot longer to get. Now, of course, when it does come to the issues and we look at even people who may agree with us on the fundamental issue of the right to life, even people who may agree with us, can get fooled by some of the rhetoric of our friends holding and seeking public office who have missed the entire point of public office. Because they say, oh, well, you know, I have to represent all the people. You know, and not everybody agrees. I respect your views. You've all gotten these letters, right? I respect your views. I respect your passion, your conviction about the right to life and the unborn, about abortion. But you see, I'm elected to represent all the people, and not everybody agrees with this, and that's why I take a personally opposed but pro-choice position. You represent all the people? That's what we're trying to say to you. You're not representing all the people unless you first protect all the people. We're the ones saying you've got to represent all the people because there's a whole category of people over here that you don't even think are people in the first place. How on earth are you representing them? You're not representing all the people. And then if you push them hard enough, they'll say, well, you know, I'm not, it's not my job to impose my beliefs on anybody else. But we're not asking you to. Is anyone here in favor of legislation that would require people by force of law to believe something? God forbid that we should ever have any kind of legislation like that. You know, we all believe here, we prayed at the beginning of the evening tonight, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. We believe that God is one in three persons. That's as true as it is to say that the sun's going to rise tomorrow morning. But we would not be in favor of laws saying that as a citizen of these United States, you must believe that God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Otherwise, there's going to be legal penalties. We wouldn't agree with or support anything like that. We don't want laws that force people to believe things. You see, the point of the law protecting life is that you're protecting people despite the beliefs of others. Suppose somebody came along and they said, I don't believe that you're human. I don't believe that you have a soul. Well, what are you going to say to that person? You broke the law? No, they didn't break the law. But if in the name of their belief they try to take your life, then they've broken the law. So the law is protecting you from someone's belief. It's not imposing any belief on them. Listen, if somebody doesn't want to believe that I'm human, there actually are some people out there. If someone doesn't want to believe I have a right to life, I say let them believe whatever in the world they want, but don't let them touch me. That's the point. The law is, regardless of belief, is there to protect what is demonstrably, evidently, obviously, biologically human life. And there is no disagreement about that. The disagreement about the value of that life. What you want to believe, you go ahead and believe it. Suppose somebody believes that stealing is okay. Well, they're entitled to their beliefs. They could write a book about why they think that stealing is okay. But if they steal, they're going to be in trouble. Oh, but, you know, ultimately we have to agree to disagree, some of these candidates will tell us, and some of these office holders. Agree to disagree. I'll respect your view, you respect mine. Sorry, but that doesn't carry any weight either. You know why? Because we're not talking here about viewpoints. merely. We're talking about violence. We're not talking here simply about beliefs. We're talking about bloodshed. I was in New York City on September 11th of 2001. We were able to see from my office building the smoke arising from the Twin Towers before we even knew what was going on. We're having our morning staff briefing, and there it was, these billowing columns of smoke. And we all remember how that day unfolded. Brothers and sisters, what was the evil of September 11th? Was it that buildings were destroyed and lives were lost? Was that the evil of September 11th? The evil of terrorism? Well, what if there were an earthquake that day and just as many buildings fell and just as many lives were lost? That would have been a terrible loss. But would that have been evil? Would that have been terrorism? Isn't there a difference between what happened on September 11th and what we as a nation continue bravely fighting across this earth? Isn't there a big difference between that and what would have happened if there were an earthquake or a tidal wave? Of course there is. But what is that difference? It's that the essence of the evil of September 11th was that some people had a callous disregard for the right to life of other people. That's what it boils down to. Some people had no regard for the claims of innocent human life. Isn't that exactly the evil that you and I are sitting here tonight to oppose? That some have absolutely no regard for the right to life of that child who happens to be living inside of another person. Does it make a difference whether the victim is 5 feet tall or 5 inches tall? Does it make a difference in the world whether the instrument you use is an airplane or surgical forceps? These circumstances make no moral difference. The moral evil is exactly the same. And brothers and sisters, therefore, when somebody comes along to me and says, "Oh, well, we will agree to disagree. You're against abortion and I'm for it." I say, sorry, but no deal. Because when somebody is perpetrating violence against somebody else, you don't sit back and agree to disagree with the perpetrator. You stop the perpetrator. That's what you do. And that's what you and I are committed to do in this nation. We're committed to stop the violence of abortion, not to simply disagree with those who are permitting it. That's what it means to have solidarity with people who are truly our brothers and sisters. Just like having solidarity with the poor is an obligation for us as Christians. Having solidarity with those who are oppressed in any number of ways, and we can all develop a long litany of oppression in our world, we are in solidarity with the victims. And this is a movement, if it is a movement of anything, this is a movement of solidarity as well. And this is a movement, finally, my friends, that is whose starting point is victory. It is built on a foundation of victory. We are in the Easter season now. In fact, we are still in Easter day. This whole week is as one day. Today is Easter Wednesday. And we have celebrated the glory of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Well, that's our starting point. Death has been conquered. When the Lord Jesus Christ rose from the tomb, he did not just conquer his death. He conquered yours. He overturned the entire kingdom of death. He overturned the power of abortion. Death has been robbed of its power. And that is our starting point. We are celebrating, we are proclaiming, we are serving, we are spreading a victory that has already been won. We're not just working for victory. We are working from victory. Let that victory, already in our hands, inspire us to work even harder. Because if these are bright days for our movement, as I have said they are, and if these are days of momentum and progress, which will continue, The last thing that means is that we are supposed to relax. The last thing that means is that we're not needed anymore in this cause. The last thing that means is that we can sit back and just enjoy the victory. No, brothers and sisters, let's enjoy the victory, but let's make us work harder than ever before to bring this cause truly over the finish line. We will see it in our lifetime. Jesus Christ is risen and is among us. And in His name, I say to you, thank you for what you do for the right to life. And let us together prepare for the banquets that we will have, celebrating the fact that once again, every human being, not just some, but every human being is welcomed and protected. God, bring us that day quickly. Amen.